Welcome to Ghostbiz here on Nova 103.5. I'm Gary Struble, and every week I get to chat to the finance ghost about what's going on in the markets around us. So, Ghost, welcome back to the show. Let's just first start out with Sanlam and Assupol. I think for most people in the street, you'd say, well, they're competitors. Sanlam is now the proud owner of Assupol, is the headline in your newsletter. Just tell us a little bit about what's happened on that deal.
Hi, Gary. Hi to all the listeners. Thanks for having me as always. I really enjoy doing the show with you. So look, you're right. I mean, they are competitors, and that's exactly the point, actually, is that basically it's like corporate Pac-Man. You know, the little yellow guy does his wagga 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 across the screen and eats up all the dots. And Assupol is one of the many dots that Sanlam has gone and eaten up over the years. Very, very acquisitive financial services group, not just in South Africa, but they've also built a pretty decent emerging markets business, actually. They've got major investments in India and other places as well. And yeah, as I say, you know, Assupol is just one example of the Sanlam growth strategy. They very much use a mix of organic growth, which means growing your existing businesses, and then inorganic growth, which means going and acquiring things that are complementary to what you are doing. And basically, Assupol just gives them more access to what they call their like retail mass customer base. You know, it's very much in line with that. So when Sanlam sits there at head office and they figure out what they're going to do, you know, they kind of draw out their group and look at all the different verticals they operate in. And Assupol just happened to be a very good fit for one of them. And so they pulled the trigger on an acquisition. And eventually, you know, you can get to a point where you have so much market share in a specific space that if the competition regulators actually kind of prevent you from doing further deals. Sanlam, I don't think is there yet because financial services is actually such a competitive market with so many players. But there are many South African companies that have probably hit their threshold in terms of being able to do acquisitions. And often that's why you see them then doing things like going offshore to do deals, which can sometimes end quite badly. But for now, at least, Sanlam is able to keep growing like this.
Now, the story on the newsletter that I found quite interesting was the one around Jubilee Metals, where they are acquiring a stake in a open pit copper mining operation in Zambia. Now, at the same time, over the last couple of weeks, it's become pretty evident Zambia has some enormous power issues with drought and problems at their Kariba operation. Perhaps let's just look at those two things in context. Is mining still a good play in Zambia if the government is struggling to keep the lights on?
Yeah, so I'm definitely not going to profess to be any kind of expert on Zambian mining, that's for sure. But obviously, I do read everything that Jubilee Metals puts out there. And it has been very interesting to see their copper strategy kind of coming through. They've got the Sable refinery, they've got these open pit copper mines, and they're basically building this like vertically integrated business in Zambia. And to your point, the power is a concern. Like it is in so many emerging markets, actually. I mean, lest we forget load shedding. Feels like a long time ago in South Africa, the power was an issue, but it was really only a few months ago, and I always fear that it might come back. So what a lot of these mining groups then do is they tap into private sector, basically power solutions. So, you know, in South Africa, they'll go and do their own solar deals, although they don't have to. They can go and do like power purchasing agreements. We just saw one of those actually at Northern Platinum. And over in Zambia, you know, it can be a relatively similar story. They can go and secure power from private producers, so they're not reliant on the grid. They are instead reliant on the beautiful African sun, which does tend to shine for most of the year, or whatever the case may be. There's lots of other renewable energy projects in Africa as well. And Jubilee is no different. So I think they are building something quite special in Zambia, but it's going to take time. And, you know, the market doesn't always have patience for that. So share prices don't always reflect that. But yeah, it's pretty clever what they're doing, vertically integrated, and they've secured power. So if anyone is interested in investing in copper or quite likes the Zambian growth story for whatever particular reason, go do some reading on Jubilee. It's a pretty interesting group.
An interesting company on the JSE, simply because it occupies such a unique space in the global investment market, is Richemont, who are an owner of a number of very high-end luxury brands. They took a bit of a punt on a company called Net-a-Porter, owned by Yuke's, but that hasn't gone well, and now it looks like they're exiting. Tell us a little bit more about the story.
No, it hasn't gone well at all. So Yuke's Net-a-Porter is a very strangely named business. And basically all it is an online store for luxury. And I mean serious luxury. So we're talking Richemont level luxury here, where you can go and buy, you know, a pair of shoes that is the same price as taking the family on holiday, for example. And much, much more than that. You know, if you've ever looked at luxury products, the numbers really do get very eye-watering. I think it's extremely difficult for us mere mortals to truly understand why people buy this stuff, but they do. And there's a market for it. And it's a free world where you can do what you want with your money. So if there's demand for something, there will be product. But I think the issue here is that in that market, it really is a bit of an event to go to these boutiques. You know, a lot of the shopping happens at airports, for example. If you've ever flown through Dubai or anywhere else, or literally anywhere else, actually, you'll always see these boutiques. Even when I was in Istanbul a couple of weeks ago, you know, there's a beautiful new mall just in the northern part of Istanbul. And the whole top floor is this gorgeous piazza with, you know, all these boutiques and this really great restaurant in the middle. Apparently, it's a Michelin star. Long story short, it's an event. It's an event to go there, to be seen there in the real upper echelons of society. Whereas logging onto a website and buying a very expensive handbag is not actually an event. You're not going to a boutique and feeling special. So I think that the business model is flawed. And, you know, Yuxa's performance suggests that I may well be right. They are being acquired from Richemont by another group that also does online luxury called Mytheresa. I went and had a look at the Mytheresa share price and it kind of told me that, you know, it's just as hard for them as it's been for Yuxa. Unfortunately for Richemont, they've lost a lot of money on Yuxa. They kind of bought them in the hope that maybe, you know, online would turn out to be a big deal. I think for Richemont, it was as much a hedge as anything else, just in case the world changed and Richemont was left without an online channel. Luckily for Richemont, the world didn't change. I think people still want to buy the stuff in store. And Yuxa was just hopelessly subscale and just a mess. So basically what Richemont has done is they've agreed to put it into the Mytheresa business effectively. And in return, Richemont will get a large stake in what is now the enlarged business. Richemont also has to put more money into Yuxa for the deal to actually work. So it's really not a great exit at all for Richemont. In fact, it's not an exit. It's basically a business combination with Mytheresa, and Richemont will hold in the enlarged group. And the thesis here is that maybe things will get better with scale. Is it a guarantee? Absolutely not. Do I think that it's going to work out well long term? Probably not. But net-net, Richemont's actually better off that it didn't work out because it means Richemont's core business is still fine.
And then just lastly, let's talk a little bit about property. There was a story around Sirius expecting property valuations to start increasing. And of course, that's in Europe, mostly in the UK and German markets where they have some exposure. You seem to be quite bullish around property in general as well. Give us an idea of why that would be.
So property is all about macroeconomic cycles and specifically what is happening to interest rates. And in the last few years, we really got a crash course on the impact that interest rates will actually have on equity markets, thanks to the Fed cutting so severely and then hiking so severely. It was like an accelerated view of what really happens normally over several years. And when interest rates are high, it's not good for property. And there are actually two reasons for this. The first one is that property funds have a lot of debt. So quite simply, the rates are high. They need to pay more money to the banks. Good for the banks, not good for the shareholders. That's the basic one. The much more complicated thing to understand is that when interest rates are high, you have a scenario where people are demanding very high yields. Now, the property generates rental income, and that rental income doesn't magically change just because interest rates are high. But instead, people can go and get great yields elsewhere. You know, if interest rates are high, they can go and buy whatever it is, fixed deposit investments or, you know, all kinds of things, get a great yield. So they basically look at these properties and say, well, you know, if that's the rental that can come out, I require a much higher return. And so therefore, I'm only prepared to pay less for those properties for the return to come out at the levels I need. Now, when interest rates start to fall, the opposite happens. It's not so easy to get yield elsewhere. And so people look at it and say, okay, well, I'm actually willing to pay a bit more now for that rental stream because my alternatives are suddenly not so great. So you now have this scenario where, you know, property funds are actually benefiting from rates coming down because their debt is getting cheaper. People are putting more value on the properties themselves. And we are at a very delightful point in the property cycle. However, the market knows this. It's not a shock. And the right time to buy property, or at least the best time, was several months ago. I have been writing about that quite consistently, I think, in Ghostmail. you know, the right time really was at the start of the year. And I took quite a significant long position on property for that reason, because we knew that rates would start dropping. No one knew exactly when, but it had to start happening. And so property for that reason has been quite good. And if you go and read the results that are coming out now from the likes of Sirius, Schroeder Real Estate as well, they said much the same thing in Europe. Property values have stabilized. They're not going up just yet, but they're not going down anymore. So this is hopefully now the beginning of that cycle really starting to play out. I think there are still good returns in property, but I think some of the best moves would have happened in anticipation of the cycle rather than once it's already obvious.
That's it for this week's edition of Ghost Biz. Thanks to the finance ghost. He can wander off back into the halls where he's ghosting. And we'll talk to him again next week right here on the Business Report.